It's good to welcome you all here today. Hope you enjoyed your 2 weeks off. Got to not have me ranting in your ears for two straight weeks. So today we come to a pretty crucial watershed in the history of redemption. And that's the rise of the monarchy in Israel. Israel didn't start with a monarchy. It spent a couple centuries in the promised land without a centralized government of any kind. And we'll talk a little bit about that as we get into our study today. But this is a pretty important development, not only for the nation of Israel, just in terms of their own life as a people, but also in terms of the history of salvation. And to illustrate what I mean just quickly, we can recap the two most significant promises that have brought us up to this point so far. There's the promise in Genesis 3, which is known as the Proto-Evangelion, or the first pronouncement of the gospel. And that's when the woman is told that her seed would crush the serpent's head. And we talked about at that time how that's foretelling the birth of Christ and how a member of the human race would undo the curse caused by the human race. And we saw how the genealogies in Genesis, as tedious as they are for us moderns to read, are actually the story of God's preservation of that line, first through Seth and then through Noah and then through Shem, all the way up to Abraham. And so there's a direct lineage from Eve to Abraham. And that's the second promise. When God calls him out of Ur in Genesis 12, he tells Abraham that he will bless all the nations through his seed or through his offspring. And so we're seeing that God is keeping a seed alive. He's keeping a lineage or a genealogy of men alive for the sake of ultimately undoing the curse. And that as time unfolds, that seed's getting more and more narrow, right? Because the seed of the woman is all human beings. But then it's Seth and not Cain. Of course, Cain kills Abel. Seth is his replacement. So God is bringing life out of death. And then it's Shem of all Noah's sons. And then it's Abraham. And then it's not all of Abraham's sons. It's only the son of the promise, Isaac. And then we get this all the way to Israel. So as we see the growth of the monarchy, and we'll see this in more detail next week, even within the chosen people, we're seeing that line get more narrowly defined. I mean, who that seed is going to be, you know, where that person is going to come from, who's ultimately going to fulfill the promise given all the way back at the fall that God would redeem the human race. And so tonight we're going to be learning about how God begins the process of what I've called tonight's lesson, reclaiming the throne. God is going to reclaim the reign over human race to himself. Of course, we believe that God is as God's sovereign over his creatures and reigns in a way. But part of the fall was our leaving God's royal domain and choosing to govern the world on our own, which is why there's just so much sin and chaos and death around us. And so God is in the process of reestablishing his personal reign. And he does that through the monarchy of Israel. We're moving now past some of the abstractions we've kind of been bogged down in the last few weeks, learning about the tabernacle, the sacrifices of the law, holy war, and all this stuff was kind of heady and up here. And I think it was important for us to spend time there, though, because some of those passages are difficult for us to read, but also because they set the scene for what Israel's vocation is as a nation, and that is to be a place where God reveals himself to the whole world. So in that sense, they're never just for themselves. Their whole national history is in service to this promise to Abraham that God would bless the nations through his descendants. And so even in this stage of salvation history, when God has revealed himself uniquely to Israel and not to the other races of man, even in that role, in that place and time, Israel still has this vocation to reveal to the human race who God is and what our condition is before him. Because apart from God's revelation in a fallen world, we wouldn't know. I mean, we modern Christians live in a world where Christianity has in many respects triumphed. The knowledge of God is everywhere. But we're coming in towards the end of the story, right? At this stage in our history as a race, knowledge of God is very rare. And so God is unfolding human history to reveal these truths to us. So I appreciate you bearing with me through all that stuff. So two weeks ago, when we met last, we talked about holy war and Israel's arrival into the land of Canaan. And we talked about some pretty heavy stuff that I'm not going to spend time on today, except to just recap some crucial bits that are relevant to our study of the rise of the monarchy. You remember that God told the Israelites to wipe out the Canaanites. And there was a very specific group of peoples that they were called to engage in holy war against. And so Israel's mandates to wage this particular kind of war wasn't for all people everywhere. It was only for the people living in the land that God had promised them. I talked about that in terms of language of sacrifice and worship. So when God tells the Israelites to totally destroy, often our English Bibles render it as utterly destroy or totally destroy. The word in Hebrew is cherem, which is actually a cultic term for consecrate or set aside. And it's all this imagery of the burnt sacrifice, where the whole animal's consumed on the altar and given to God, in that sense of the smoke rising into heaven. And that's what Israel's doing with the Canaanites, in part because God is bringing judgment on them as his holiness enters into an unholy world. Israel herself, of course, is liable to the same mode of destruction if she engages in the same practices as the Canaanites themselves. And we saw in Deuteronomy 20 that that's one of the reasons why God wanted them to wipe them out. He says, this is verses 17 and 18 of Deuteronomy 20, "In the cities of these peoples that the Lord your God is giving you, you shall save alive nothing, but you shall devote to complete destruction." That whole phrase in English is the single Hebrew verb, cherem. "That they may not teach you to do according to all their abominable practices that they have done for their gods, and so you sin against the Lord your God." And so part of the reason he wants them to this is such a harsh command in a fallen world, for Israel to totally destroy the people who were in Canaan already, it's because he doesn't want them to be adulterated by their practices. One of which, as we talked last time we were together, was the sacrifice of their own children to the Molechs. And one of the signs of Israel's apostasy later in its history is when it starts doing the same thing. Some of Israel's kings sacrificed their children to Molech, one of the Canaanite deities. In Leviticus chapter 18, God tells Israel that they have a holy vocation, and they're to be a holy people, and that they're not to practice the abominable practices of the Canaanites. But then God tells them, because if you do, the land will vomit you out, just as it vomited them out. Right? So the same strictures also apply to Israel as applied to the Canaanites. In Judges 1 and 2, Israel comes into the promised land. The book of Joshua is all about that initial stage of the conquest. God says he's going to drive out the peoples a little bit slowly so that they're not overwhelmed by an empty land. And so Joshua only recounts the very first stage of the conquest. But then the very first chapter of Judges, we see individual tribes now in the land of Canaan continuing the conquest of the peoples who are in their tribal allotments. And I think for those of you who have your Bibles, most Bibles now will have a map in the back that'll show you the way the land was divided by to the tribes. And all of this geography is described in excruciating detail in the book of Numbers. So it's not just modern people imagining. This is actually based on the biblical text. But then it goes on to say, as chapter 1 is sort of winding down, it starts talking about tribes that didn't drive out the Canaanites from their land, who allowed them to stay. And then in chapter 2, an angel of the Lord appears. This is now after Joshua's death. "Now an angel of the Lord went up from Gilgal to Bochim, and he said, 'I brought you up from Egypt and brought you into the land that I swore to give your fathers. I said, I will never break my covenant with you, and you shall make no covenant with the inhabitants of this land. You shall break down their altars, but you have not obeyed my voice. What is this you have done? So now I say, I will not drive them out before you, but they shall become thorns in your sides, and their gods shall be a snare to you.' As soon as the angel of the Lord spoke these words to all the people of Israel, the people lifted up their voices and wept, and they called the name of the place Bochim, and they sacrificed there to the Lord God. When Joshua dismissed the people of Israel went each to his inheritance to take possession of the land. And the people served the Lord all the days of Joshua, and all the days of the elders who outlived Joshua, who had seen all the great work that the Lord had done for Israel. And Joshua, the son of Nun, the servant of the Lord, died at the age of 110 years. And they buried him within the boundaries of his inheritance in Timnath-Heres, in the hill country of Ephraim, north of the mountain of Gaash. All that generation who were gathered to their fathers, and there arose another generation after them." This is a crucial phrase. It gets used all throughout the Old Testament. "Another generation rose up who did not know the Lord or the work that he had done for Israel. And the people of Israel did what was evil in the sight of the Lord and served the Baals." Now, Baal is one of the deities of the Canaanite pantheon. And so Israel is now worshiping the gods of the Canaanites. They're not worshiping the God who brought them out of Egypt. "And they abandoned the Lord, the God of their fathers, who had brought them out of the land of Egypt. Then they went after other gods from among the gods of the peoples who were around them and bowed down to them, and they provoked the Lord to anger. They abandoned the Lord and served the Baals and the Asheroth. Ashtaroth is considered the female counterpart to Baal in the Canaanite deity, in the pantheon. So the anger of the Lord was kindled against Israel, and he gave them over to plunderers who plundered them. And he sold them into the hand of their surrounding enemies so that they could no longer withstand their enemies. Whenever they marched out, the hand of the Lord was against them for harm, as the Lord had warned. We just read one of those passages from Leviticus where he said this would happen if they fell away from him. And so the Lord had sworn to them, and they were in terrible distress. So we see what's happening to Israel is because they haven't wiped out the Canaanites the way God told them to, they're becoming like the Canaanites. And one of the great scholars of the book of Judges talks about the Canaanization of Israel, that they're becoming like the people who were already there, which God hates. Their practices are abominable to him, sacrificing their own children and whatnot. And as much as Israel becomes like them, the more God's going to continue to subject them to the same fate that he subjected the Canaanites. And this process ends up taking several centuries. And ultimately, the exile of Israel, which we'll get to later, can be understood in those terms, that God finally makes good on his promise to kick them out of the Holy Land for just years and years of disobedience. But at this stage in the story, they're relatively newly arrived, and so God, when they cry out in distress, has mercy on them, and what he does is he raises up a judge to deliver them. And the word judge is important because he's not raising up kings for them. He's raising up judges who are sort of ad hoc rulers, and they're usually military rulers, people who can organize the armies of Israel and retaliate against Israel's enemies in a coordinated fashion. And then as soon as that person does that and peace is restored to the land, the people are usually faithful for as long as that judge is alive, and then as soon as that judge dies, they fall back into apostasy and the whole cycle starts over. And the second chapter of Judges basically outlines this procedure, which then is the whole rest of the book in more detail. So Israel continues to act like the Canaanites around them. And then when they cry out, when God punishes them, God raises up a judge. Of course, this is not a very stable arrangement. The very reality of it, the fact that God doesn't raise up a centralized king for them, illustrates very clearly Israel's sort of unique vocation among all the nations around them. And that is that God is their king. Very, very literally. They didn't think about God in the sort of religion versus over here versus state over here the way we modern Americans think about it. The law for the Israelites wasn't just a religious code that occupied their time in religious activities. The law was their legal code as a people, as a nation. And that the code itself assumes that the chief executive and lawmaker is God. God is actually their king in a very political sense. And so God is their king, and the reason why it's not going well for them is because they're unfaithful. Not because God is not present, but because they don't follow him. And he raises up these rulers who are answerable to him in very constrained circumstances, and they kind of keep things stable as long as they're alive, but then as soon as they die, it unravels again. And we're going through all of this just to set up the rise of the monarchy in the book of Samuel, which is what the book of 1 and 2 Samuel is about. I had you start reading in chapter 9, I think, for your reading for tonight. And all of this is just by way of background to illustrate that Israel, after about 400 years, is tired of this just instability, this seesawing back and forth between strong military rulers that can save them and nobody. Of course, Israel doesn't own up to their own role in all of this, of course. But Samuel is the last of the judges. He's also a prophet. Samuel tries to raise up his own kids to be judges after him, and that goes dismally badly. It says here that, chapter 8. This is Samuel now. Yet his sons did not walk in his ways, but turned aside after gain. They took bribes and perverted justice. And so in verse 4 of this chapter, the elders of Israel gather and they make a request to Samuel. Then all the elders of Israel gathered together and came to Samuel at Ramah and said to him, "Behold, you are very old and your sons do not walk in your ways. Now appoint for us a king." And the word they use there is the Hebrew word for king as opposed to judge. Mishpat is judge, Melech is king. They've used the word king. Give us a king. Where does it say this? "Give us a king to judge us, like all the nations." So Israel provides some explanatory gloss on what they mean exactly. They don't just want a king in the abstract. They want a king like the nations around them have, right? Of course, Israel's vocation as a nation is to be unique among the nations in that they are uniquely answerable to the one true God who is their king. And so by asking for a king like the nations, what are they saying about God as king? Not good enough, right? Which is exactly what happens, right? So Samuel hears this. You want a king like the nations have. And Samuel, but the thing displeased Samuel, this is verse 6, when they said, give us a king to judge us. And Samuel prayed to the Lord, and the Lord said to Samuel, obey the voice of the people and all that they say to you, for they have not rejected you, but they have rejected me from being king over them. So God is acknowledging this to Samuel quite plainly, that their request for a king like the nations have is a tantamount to rebellion, a sort of, you might say, coup against God, a revolution. They want to throw God out of the political spectrum. They want a king like the nations have. And God relents to this. God gives them what they ask for. God tells Samuel to raise up for them a king like the nations have. What we can see in this is that, and this is part of Israel's role, I told you their role is to reveal to the nations the nature of who God is and our relationship as a race to him who made us. And one of the first things that our first parents did was reject God's authority over them. They rejected his role as their king. We talked about how the image of God in man is in this ancient Near Eastern context. It's within the context of them sharing in God's sovereign mandate to rule the works of his hands. So he creates mankind to be sub-kings under himself, the way that a lot of the kingdoms of that world were arranged, where you'd have a high king and kings underneath them that would rule smaller bits of the kingdom. That was what mankind was. That's what it meant to bear God's image, to rule with him. And by disobeying God, by throwing off his word, we rejected his kingship. We rejected his reign. And Israel is now doing the exact same thing. They're throwing off God. If anybody had reason to trust in God and to commit themselves to follow him and be obedient to him, it's Israel. How much have they seen at this point as a nation? They've seen the Exodus. They've been fed from manna. They've been given water to drink from a rock. They've now seen God drive out peoples, destroy cities. And even with this knowledge, the human heart stuck in sin can't bring itself to obedience to God. So they cast off the rule of God, just like our first parents did. And Israel as a nation is now doing, as a nation in their own history, exactly what the human race did. And so Israel as a nation in that sense is standing in for, symbolizing in their own history, the whole of the human race. And I think God is doing that on purpose. I think God knows it's going to play out that way. You remember in Deuteronomy, Moses predicts they're not going to be faithful to the law. That Israel's vocation in part is to reveal to the world that the human heart is broken and sinful and incapable of obeying God, even when it has all the things at their disposal to obey him. They have the prophets, they have the law, they have the temple to deal with sin and uncleanliness. Even with all this, they can't do it. And so this is not just a random moment in the history of Israel as a nation. This is pretty crucial for what their role is, so that both they learn and we learn who are now watching them how serious our condition is as people. That we reject the reign of God. So in chapter 9, moving forward, a young man named Saul is chosen to be king over the people of Israel. And at first glance, he seems like a perfect fit. Now remember, the context for this is that Israel is tired of being mopped up by their enemies. They want a king who's a military ruler. You know, put away all of those images of the British royal court with all its pomp and circumstance, with big palaces, and that's not the world these people live in. Kings are basically strong men who win battles for you and keep the peace for your people and your territory. That's what they are. And so that's what they want. They want a military ruler. They want a man who can lead them in battle and, you know, lead armies and fight and win. And so when he comes across Saul, there's a couple of things about him which on human terms, a king like the nations after all, what do kings like the nations have? They have wealth. They have... they're usually winsome and handsome, and they're usually big, brawny men who can win battles. And Saul is all of those things. He's exactly what you'd think the people need. We're told that he comes from a wealthy house. This is now chapter 9. A Benjaminite. So we're talking about now Saul's father, a man of wealth. Verse 1. Verse 2, and he had a son whose name was Saul, a handsome young man. There was not a man among the people of Israel more handsome than he. From his shoulders upward, he was taller than any of the people. So he's big. He's a big guy. And so you would think this is the guy we need. This is the guy who's going to solve all our problems for us, right? And so God tells Samuel to anoint him, and the Spirit comes on Saul. I'm sorry, Samuel's to anoint Saul. The Spirit rushes on Saul, and he's with the prophets, and is Saul among the prophets, and people are seeing sort of a divine work here, and so he's made king. But looks can be deceiving, as we learn quickly. If we notice the details, beyond just the fact that he's handsome and big, Saul is actually not what Israel needs. And the first crucial detail is his name. Saul comes from the Hebrew word, it's the same root for to ask. To ask, you'd ask a question, you might ask for something, right? And Israel has just asked Samuel for a king, and God gives them, in Hebrew literally, you asked for it. That's what Saul's name is. You asked, here it is. You asked for it. That's his name. Saul, to ask. And this first story about him is about looking for his father's lost, is it sheep or goats? I think it's goats. Donkeys. His lost donkeys. And one of the things that's important to recognize about the narrative structure here is in ancient Near Eastern storytelling, the very first words out of a character's mouth are usually a sort of summation of who they are for the rest of the story. And Saul's very first words were, come, let us go back. He wants to give up the search before they found the donkeys, right? He's a quitter. That's how Saul starts out, right? And it's his own servant that's goading him on. Like, no, let's just go a little further. I think there's a holy man, a seer in Ramah who can help us. And Saul agrees to go along with this. So he's indecisive. He's a quitter. He's listening to his own servants who are telling him what to do. He doesn't even recognize Samuel when he sees him. In fact, he asks Samuel. Samuel walks right in front of him, and he's like, hey, I'm looking for a prophet who's supposed to be here. And Samuel's like, you found him. I'm right here. So Saul is depicted from the outset as a man who's not exactly sharp in the senses. He may be tall, he may be handsome, but already the narrative is asking us to be a little suspicious of him. And then as we progress to chapter 10, when Samuel gathers all the elders together and says, okay, we're going to cast lots and see who God's picked. Of course, Samuel already knows. The lot, of course, falls to Saul, but they can't find him anywhere. Does anybody remember where Saul is when they're casting all these lots to try to, and the lot lands on Benjamin, then it lands on a particular clan within Benjamin, and it gets to Saul's father's house, and it gets to Saul. Where is Saul when this happens? Sorry? He's hiding. He's hiding among the baggage, right? He's hiding. So already it's not going well for Saul, okay? So this is who Israel asks for, right? He is in very many respects a king like the nations. He's a man who is, he's weak, he's indecisive, he's paranoid, he's obsessed with his own image. We'll get to that in a little bit. He's not above using manipulative tactics, blaming others. He's definitely a king like the nations have. Classic politician. Can't trust him with your own baby, right? They kiss babies and steal their lollipops. This is who Saul is. And even when the Spirit of God rushes on him and Samuel's like, you're going to have to become a different person, it's not enough. One last detail before we move on to the next chapter. Saul is anointed by Samuel. And this is very crucial. Because when we think about kings now becoming kings, we think about some ornate ceremony, the climax of which is usually what? What's the climax of a king becoming a king? According to Western court, coronation. What happens at coronations? They're crowned, right? great climax of Elizabeth's coronation in the 1950s was putting on her head the crown of St. Edward, who's ancient king of England. Kings back in this day weren't crowned. They were anointed with oil, and they were anointed by a prophet who was supposed to be basically a stand-in for God. God is the person who's anointing this person. And when they're anointed with oil, the oil itself is actually a symbol for the Spirit of God resting on them and directing them to do and to lead exactly as God would. And so they become vice regents of God. And so that's what it means to be a king, is to be anointed. And the word for anointed in Hebrew is Messiah, Mashiach in Hebrew. So when Samuel anoints Saul, Saul becomes the Lord's Messiah. He becomes Israel's king. And that's the very first occurrence of this word anointed in this particular context in the Hebrew scriptures. We've already seen another character be anointed in Israel's history. Anybody remember who that person is who's also anointed with oil as a sign of the Spirit? Anybody remember who else is anointed in Israel's economy as a nation? It's the high priest. Aaron's the first person to be Messiah for Israel. He's anointed to serve as priest, and all the high priests after him are anointed in a similar fashion. So, as a quick just tangent, this is what I think is going on in Matthew's gospel. When Jesus comes up to John the Baptist and insists on being baptized by him, and John says, no, don't do it, I need to be baptized by you. And Jesus says, no, it's fitting to fulfill all righteousness. Israelite kings don't crown or coronate themselves. They're always anointed by a prophet of God, always. There's never any difference. So when David wants to have Solomon anointed, he asks the high priest to do it. It's always the way it works. And so by Jesus submitting himself to John the Baptist, who was clearly the prophet of God of that age, before Jesus, Jesus is allowing God's prophet to tell Jesus who he is. And of course, when John does it, it ends up not being John at all. It ends up being God the Father, who breaks open the heavens and says, you are my son, which in Psalm 2 is the formula in Israelite coronations of becoming a king. God adopts them as his sons. So when God says that to Jesus, this is the moment when Jesus is anointed to become Messiah, or king of Israel. And what happens to Jesus when he sees the heavens opened? That great image of his baptism. The Holy Spirit descends like a dove, right? So the anointing is a symbol of the anointing of the Holy Spirit to do the work of God's king among his people. Jesus is actually anointed by the Spirit, right? So I think that's what's going on in that story, is that Jesus is allowing God to make him king and not taking on the role himself, because that's just a usurper. But Jesus goes through the appropriate channels. He submits himself to God's prophet. God's prophet does what the prophet in this case does, baptizes him. And then God uses that occasion to anoint Jesus with the Holy Spirit for the work of the anointed one, Messiah, right? And this all has Old Testament precedent. Okay, back now to Samuel. Samuel chapter 15 is when we start seeing it go really bad for Saul. Let me just stop there real quick and take any questions that you might have about what we've covered up to this point. Anything that I've said that is surprising, or any detail that I didn't mention that you read and had some questions about? Yeah.
What are we to make of the fact that, what we know about history, what we infer from the text, is that prior to having a king, Israel didn't really make out that well. We were talking about poor people that basically live in the hills and get
right.
Pretty regularly.
Right.
Having a king to have somebody to sort of unite behind and lead them in battle makes a lot of sense.
Right. Well, I think the logic of the narrative up to that point is that God is that person. God is supposed to be their king. And the reason why it goes badly for Israel is not because God is asleep at the switch, but because Israel is not being faithful to him. Right? And Israel said, if you worship the Baals like the Canaanites do, you're going to get treated like the Canaanites got treated by you when I sent you in there to destroy them. And so naturally they start worshiping the Baals, and God hands them over to their enemies. So things are going badly for Israel, not because they lack a centralized monarch. They have one. They have God. But they're not faithful to him. And God will raise up these judges, sort of ad hoc leaders, to help them in that moment of crisis. But then as soon as it passes, they return to their faithlessness and are no longer obedient to their king. Right? Which is why God says to Samuel, they haven't rejected you, they've rejected me as king over them. Right? Doesn't just serve what? Right. Well, I think the point, though, is that God is not only serving in moments of crisis. Israel is abdicating on his leadership by not obeying him, and that's what creates the crisis to begin with. Now, God promises that if they obey him, everything will go well for them in the land, that their borders will be secure, he'll give them peace, he'll give them plenty. And so if that doesn't happen, the implication is they haven't been faithful to him. And I think that's the logic of the narrative. And admittedly, that's a unique arrangement, right? No other nation's arranged that way. But it doesn't work because Israel's hearts are hard. And so that's why they ask for a king like the nations who can stabilize things for them. Yeah, Cliff.
I've never thought about the significance that they're always referred to as the judges. I mean, I just think of the judicial branch, and they lack an executive branch. You know, obviously, thinking of it a certain way. But they've always been the people of the law. So my question is, did the judges, did they just serve a simple, pragmatic people, like two mothers will dispute a baby, we need somebody to decide? Or did they have a function to say, knowing God's law in this situation is going to be, we need to
right.
do this?
I think we do see that. We see, like with Deborah, for example, that she judges under this tree, you know, and she decides disputes among the Israelites. So I think they do have a little bit of a. And again, the separation of powers is a modern post-Enlightenment Western development. Ancient peoples didn't tend to think that way, and so they are exercising a joint executive judicial power. But the fact that they're not kings is significant because they're ultimately answerable to God and to his law.
You know? Well, my question was, in lieu of a book, they didn't have one, right? They didn't have a book. All they had was sort of a kind of magisterium.
No, they had the law of Moses. It was written down. The very, very first law God commands to Israel is recorded in Exodus 20. That's the very first word of what becomes the Bible is actually recorded. And as soon as God speaks it, he writes it into stone with his finger, right? And that becomes a sort of a covenant sign between Israel and their God of what he asks them to do. And then Moses actually mandates that the book of the law be read to the people at regular intervals as a nation, that they gather at the central sanctuary and that the priest will read to them the law. So it's not just oral tradition. They actually have, I mean, according to the logic of the narrative, modern scholars will disagree with this, but the Pentateuch at this point has now been written down by Moses, and they have it. Not everybody's going to have their own copy, but that it would have been available to the people to have heard read publicly at regular intervals. Of course, that is if they're being faithful to the law and doing what it says. You know, and some of that burden does, in that sense, fall extra hard on their leaders who are supposed to be extra versed in it and gather them for those things. And that comes up later with the kings when you see them trying to restore certain festival days that had sort of lapsed. And, you know, they see themselves as one of their roles is to keep Israel faithful to this system. So they did have a law. It was written down. Yeah. Yeah.
Sorry, do we know what other legal systems were in place? Because presumably one person wasn't actually deciding all the cases.
Sure. I mean, we don't know for sure. We might assume that the practice of sort of hierarchy of elders that Moses sets up at Jethro's prodding in Exodus may have continued. We don't really know for sure because the text doesn't tell us. But we might assume that's the case. It would have definitely been a very elder-driven society where like local authorities who are the chief families or the heads of the chief families would have had, you know, say over these kinds of disputes. Yeah. Okay, so. Saul is told by Samuel to take out Amalek, which is a nation currently ruled by a king called Agag. And verses 2 through 3, see if you recognize this language anywhere. Thus says the Lord of hosts, this is now Samuel talking to Saul, Thus says the Lord of hosts, I have noted what Amalek did to Israel in opposing them on the way when they came up out of Egypt. This is the guy, if I remember the narrative correctly, the Israelites ask if they can pass through his land peacefully. And Amalek says no. And Israel's like, we won't turn aside. We'll stay on the highway. We won't touch any of your stuff. We just want to pass through. We're not your enemy. And Amalek's response to that is to send out his army to take him out, right? So this is now God getting even with Amalek. Now go and strike Amalek and devote to destruction all that they have. Do not spare them, but kill both man and woman, child and infant, ox and sheep, camel and donkey. Devote to complete destruction. My Bible has a footnote there, footnote 2. That is, set apart, devote, as an offering to the Lord for destruction. So it's the word cherem. It's that holy war word. And remember that Israel was given two sets of laws about waging war. One was waging war in general against their neighbors, and one was waging war against the people in Canaan. And in Canaan's case, they were to show no quarter. But to all their enemies outside of the land God had promised them, they have much more constrained modes of conduct. They can't just kill everybody. So when God's telling them to kill everybody, and he's using this word cherem, this is holy war. This is a continuation of conquests. And so Samuel is asking Saul to continue in the mode of Joshua here and to complete the conquest of Canaan. And of course, crucial to that is the destruction of everything, the complete dedication of everything to God. And when the battle is won, Saul wins it. He is an effective commander. Two unfortunate things happen. He spares King Agag, and the text is quite explicit. This is verse 9. But Saul and the people spared Agag and the best of the sheep and of the oxen and of the fattened calves and the lambs and all that was good, and would not utterly destroy them all. All that was despised and worthless they devoted to destruction. Now remember, devoting to destruction is an act of offering to God. So you're giving them to God to deal with. And that's the fire, of course, symbolizes their being sort of shorn of their material hangings and being set up to God in the smoke, right? So by keeping for themselves all the good stuff and giving God all the crap, what are they saying to God and how important his relationship is to them? Not a whole lot, right? They're giving him what's left over. So then Samuel hears a word from God. I regret that I have made Saul king. So then Samuel goes to tell Saul this bad news. And Saul does not respond well to it. He initially attempts to play off the sin onto somebody else. Well, the people kept the sheep and the oxen. I was obedient, the people. Does that remind you of anybody at this point in the narrative? Who else did that? Right, that's what the man said when God asked him in the garden. Well, the woman you gave me, she took an eight, and she gave it to me. Right? So this is classic sin. He's playing off his guilt. Well, they're the ones that did it. Of course, God's response is, you're the king. And in verse 9, Saul is the subject of the verb, but Saul and the people with him spared Agag and the best of the sheep, right? So Saul is responsible. So Samuel shows up. It's kind of a humorous scene. Samuel shows up. Saul sees him. Oh, Samuel, great to see you, buddy. I was faithful to everything God told me to do. And, of course, God told him to destroy everything. And then Samuel, of course, reacting to the just noise of a herd, says, what's this bleeding of sheep I hear in my ears in that case? I shouldn't be hearing anything because they should be all dead, right? Saul backtracks. Well, I don't know, I was faithful, the people took, but we were going to offer those sheep as a sacrifice to God. You know, so he tries to pay off his disobedience as a sort of piety of some kind. And Samuel's like, I didn't ask you to do that. I told you to do this. So you can't cover it up by like saying that you're going to do a penance or something. It doesn't work that way. You're supposed to be obedient. So then Saul is given the bad news that God's going to take the kingdom from him. Saul, interestingly enough, is more concerned about saving face right now, right? He wants to save face. This is verses 24 and 25. But Saul said to Samuel, I have sinned, for I have transgressed the commandment of the Lord. So he's finally fessing up to it. Because I feared the people and obeyed their voice. Now he's admitting what happened. Now therefore, please pardon my sin and return with me that I may now bow before the Lord. He wants the people, his army, to see Samuel with him so that they know that Saul is still Samuel's guy, still God's guy. And this is reinforced in verse 30 when Samuel says he's not going to do it. He's like, I'm not going to go. God's not going to change his mind about you. We can talk about that if you want. I have sinned, yet honor me now before the elders of my people and before Israel, and return with me that I may bow before the Lord your God. Right? He's concerned about appearances. He's not owning the tragedy of what's happened. Right? He's a king like the nations. He's not faithful to God. Your English translations are going to kind of deceive you here, because after he says that, verse 11 says, where are we at here? So this is verse 31 of chapter 15. So Samuel turned back after Saul, and Saul bowed before the Lord. Then Samuel said, "Bring here to me Agag, king of the Amalekites." It seems to be suggesting that Samuel is going along with this, but it's a sort of technical word in Hebrew that could also be translated that he turns away from Saul. And I think that what happens next means that's really the way it needs to be understood. Because he doesn't go up with Saul to complete the sacrifice of the rams and stuff that Saul had in mind. He goes and finishes what Saul was supposed to finish and didn't. And again, it's almost humorous that Agag, who's witnessing all of this, he's been spared by Saul's army, and he sees Saul presenting him to the chief sort of cleric of Israel, and he's thinking, well, great, if they're presenting me to their high holy guy, then I've got to be, you know, I'm good to go. And that's not what happens. Samuel does the job himself, does the deed himself. Of course, ancient Israelite priests are trained butchers. They know how to cut up an animal. That's what they do. So that's what Samuel does. He sacrifices Agag the way Saul was supposed to. Then Samuel went to Ramah, and Saul went up to the house of Gibeah, and Samuel did not see Saul again until the day of his death. And Samuel grieved over Saul, and the Lord regretted that he had made Saul king over Israel. So Israel asked for a king like the nations, and they got one. The guy who's not faithful. He's not going to help them. He's not going to help them avoid acting like the Canaanites, because that's what Saul does. He acts like the Canaanites, and that's not going to get any Israel anywhere. Moving forward now to chapter 16, 1 Samuel, God tells Samuel, stop crying over Saul. His time's done. Time to move forward. We're about redemption now here, not the past. Go up to Bethlehem, and I will show you what you're to do there. It's interesting that Samuel, when he first meets Jesse's kids, he assumes that Jesse's oldest son is the guy that God wants. And it's because he's the oldest, and probably because he's the most strapping and dashing, right? Has Samuel learned anything? Right? Why did Saul present himself to him? Because he was taller than everybody, right? And this is where God corrects Samuel. Like, no, I've rejected him. I don't base my judgments on appearances. I look inside the heart, and I have not chosen this one, right? So this is what's going on here is that Israel's been given a chance to have a king like they've asked for, and now God is going to raise up a king for them who's what God has in mind, the kind of person that God thinks, should there be a human king, will serve Israel's interests. And this is not a man who's strapping and can lead them in battle, though David can do that. That's not ultimately what matters to God. What matters to God is David faithful? So Jesse presents all of his sons to Samuel. David's not even brought in from outside because he's the youngest, so it's obviously not going to be him. This is a culture that values hierarchy and seniority very, very highly. And so to go past not just the first brother, but all seven of them is definitely not normal. And so when he gets to the seven, Samuel's like, I was told to come here, but none of these guys are it. So is there more? And that's when Jesse fesses up. Well, David's outside, but he's with the sheep. So David's brought in, and immediately Samuel's told by God, this is the one I want. It's almost as if Samuel's not even given a chance to evaluate him physically. Just, this is the one I want. He anoints him, and then what happens after he anoints David? The Spirit rushes on him, right? David is now Messiah. He's Israel's anointed. Moving forward now to 1 Samuel 17, this is a famous tale that you will all have learned when you were young kids. This is the great story of David and Goliath. This is not just a story about how God uses the weak to humble the proud, though it certainly is that. I don't even think that Goliath is the chief counterpart to David in this story. I think the person that David is being compared to in the story is Saul, who's a character in the story, if you recall. The Israelite armies are arrayed against the armies of the Philistines. Goliath has come out, and he's just taunting the Israelites, who are terrified of this guy. He's huge. and they're shivering in their boots. And Saul is afraid and shivering in his boots. Now, Saul has been victorious in the battlefield. We know the guy can do it. But Goliath is just defying the armies of Israel and saying, you know, you guys are dogs. You know, just send one guy out here and we'll see how we do. And even Saul can't bring himself to go. So David shows up. At this point, we're supposed to assume that he's fairly young, maybe a teenager. We don't know for sure. The word is just young man. That could be even somebody in their early 20s. Either way, though, David's not a large guy, so he's small. And he shows up. His brothers are actually in the army, and David asks a question. This is now, remember I told you the very first line of a character in a narrative is tells you all you need to know about him. What is David's first words to, this is the first time we've now heard King David speak. Where is it here? David was really more, so this is moving on now to verse. Kids are having fun downstairs, I can tell. And David said to the men, this is now verse 26. So a man of Israel has just explained to David who Goliath is and what he's doing. And David said to the men who stood by him, "What shall be done for the man who kills this Philistine and takes away the reproach from Israel? For who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God?" That's David's first word. It's the first time we've heard David speak. Right? What a contrast to Saul. He was getting ready to give up on a search for his dad's donkeys. David's first word is, "Who's this guy? Forget about your spears and swords and shields and stuff. Don't you realize that you're the armies of God? Who is this Philistine?" So David is upset that Israel is not owning who they are in the Lord and taking this guy out. So he offers himself to Saul. And Saul, of course, is like, "You know, who are you?" And he says, "Well, who is this Philistine? I'll do it." So Saul puts his own armor on David, right? And what does David do with Saul's armor? It's too big for him, so he takes it off. Now, David uses this interesting story about his victors against big animals as a shepherd. He's like, "Well, I'll just do to this Philistine what I did to that bear and that lion that tried to attack my dad's sheep. And I'll do the same thing." Then David comes out and meets Goliath. And Goliath sees him, and he's singularly unimpressed. David's got his staff with him, probably. And so Goliath says, "You come at me with sticks?" And David says the same thing to Goliath that he had said earlier. Philistine said to David, "Am I a dog that you come at me with sticks?" And the Philistine cursed David by his gods, which of course aren't gods. The Philistines, "Come to me and I will give your flesh to the birds of the air." Then David said to the Philistine, "You come to me with a sword and with a spear and with a javelin, but I come to you in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defied." He hasn't defied Israel. He's defied God. And David is so convinced of this that he's not worried at all about who's going to have this day. And so then he starts to charge after Goliath. Goliath assumes he's going to run at him. Then David stops, and he takes a slingshot, and he takes down Goliath. Now, the sort of cartoons of our youth make us think this is like one of those like Dennis the Menace things, and he's got a little pebble, and psh, no. A slinger was actually an auxiliary soldier in the ancient world. And we've actually got caches of the polished stones they would use. They were big, usually solidly rounded balls. That's why David picks them from the creek, because they're smooth. And these slings were actually large claws that these guys would swing around and hurl. And these guys were incredibly accurate. We've got scenes and reliefs of battles of slingers kind of functioning as archers. And these guys are deadly from a distance. And these stones are not little pebbles. They're like shot puts. So if this thing hits you, it's going to hurt. So that's what David does. You know, he pulls out his sling, which is probably how he killed the bear and the lion, from a distance. He's a strategic thinker. And so Goliath is getting ready to take him out with his spear and his javelin. David just lets loose, takes him out. Right? David has faith in Yahweh. For David, this is not about military tactics and who's bigger and who's stronger and who's better trained. Now, of course, David does use his brain. He's an intelligent fighter, like I said before. But for David, that's ancillary to what's at stake here. This is not about who's better at fighting. This is about godless Philistines who don't have God and us who claim that we do. And who's going to fight for us if we let him? Right? God's going to do it. So David just knows that there's no way this Philistine can win. Contrast that with Saul, who does not see through godly lenses. He sees through very worldly lenses. He sees through power plays and manipulation. He's a paranoid, fearful man. That's not who David is. David just trusts in God because God has said that Israel is his people and that he'll defend his people. So why are we afraid? Just polar opposite of Saul. And so we see what's going on here is that Israel has asked for a king like the nations. God gives them one so they can see how well it will go for them with this guy. And then God raises up a king of his own. A man after God's own heart is how God describes David to Samuel in chapter 13. And Samuel describes David, before Samuel's even met David, to Saul in chapter 15, as better than you. God will raise up a man who's better than you. This is David. And David's better, not because he's stronger, not because he's faster, not because he's even smarter, but because he trusts Yahweh. And he trusts what Yahweh says he's going to do through Israel, his people. And that makes all the difference in the world. Moving quickly now, by way of conclusion, the whole rest of the David story is about David's rise to leadership having nothing to do with David. And the text goes out of its way. The whole rest of the first book of Samuel is about this. The book of 2 Samuel is about David's reign, when he becomes king. This is now the story of how David gets there. And in chapter 18, we have the story of David's meteoric rise. And the irony there is that Saul becomes more and more afraid of him the more and more David is successful in fighting for Saul. David's one of his generals. And he's loyal to Saul. And he's loyal to Saul's son Jonathan, which is also a major relationship at this part of the story. And Saul increasingly distrusts David until he eventually drives him out. Saul is jealous, but Saul's own son, and it's worth stressing, his own successor, Jonathan, sees the writings on the wall. When David is fleeing from Saul in chapter 23, Jonathan sneaks behind, because David's now a fugitive. Jonathan has sneaked to where David is. And he says to him in verse 25, or is it? This is chapter, where are we at here? 23, 25, 28. That's not right. Oh, here it is. It's not right either. Anyway, I can't find it. It's in here somewhere. Jonathan goes out to meet David. And Jonathan tells David, I'm your man. I know that you're going to succeed my father. The Lord has chosen you, and that you'll be king, and I'll be second to you. Right? So this is the heir to the throne telling David that he knows he's going to be second to David. And Jonathan says something very interesting. He says, even my father knows this. And so even Saul's own son and heir recognizes what God's doing in David and is loyal to David over his father. Of course, Jonathan's a dutiful son. He stays by his father's side, but the whole thing grieves him to see the way his father behaves towards David. David flees for the sanctuary of God in chapter 21. Saul finds out that he's there, interrogates the priests, and then murders them all. And only one of them escapes. These are the priests that descend from Aaron. And only one, Abiathar, escapes. And he goes to David's camp and says, Saul just killed us all. I'm the only survivor. And David says, stay with me. You'll be safe. But crucially, Abiathar brings the high priest's ephod, which is how you inquire of the Lord. And so throughout the narrative, we find David inquiring of the Lord, even though he's on the run. And that's because the surviving high priest is with David, not with Saul. So David's got even Yahweh's representative and the priest with him. There are two opportunities that David has to take out Saul, chapter 24 and 26. Saul slips up. He exposes himself to David. David, his own men are like, Saul, take him out. And David's like, I can't. Why? I can't kill the Lord's anointed. So David doesn't do it. But then he tells Saul that he doesn't do it. And he shouts to Saul later, like he takes a piece of his garment or takes a staff. You know, Saul, why are you coming after me? I'm not your enemy. You know, so Saul knows. Saul has no reason to be hateful of David. He has no excuse. Even this strange story with Abigail is illustrative of David's rise on God's behalf, because David is incensed by what Abigail's husband says to David and his men, and David's going to kill them all, and Abigail stops David's hand from doing it. She sort of shrewdly maneuvers to prevent David from doing what David has set out to do. And she says to David, I'm going to, you know, I wanted to prevent you from spilling blood unjustly. And David's like, God sent you to keep me from spilling blood unjustly. And then ultimately, her husband then is just struck dead by God. Right? So here again, we're seeing God is the architect of David's fate and not David. When David's left to his own devices, even he is liable to failures and mistakes, but God protects him. And then the sort of crucial moment, the climax of the psalm, the very end of 1 Samuel, chapter 29, David has now fled to the Philistines, and he's hired himself out to the Philistines to be a mercenary for them. He's fighting for Israel's enemy. And the Philistine army is going up against the Israelites at Jezreel. And the king of the Philistines brings David with him because David's been a very faithful servant. But when all the Philistine generals see David there, of course they know David because he had killed his tens of thousands of Philistines. Like, who's this? Like, what are you bringing him for? We're not going to, like, is an enemy behind the lines? Like, we're not going to fight with him. And the Philistine king tries to defend David. Like, no, he's been faithful to me this whole time. He's been in my service. Don't worry. He's with us now. And they refuse to let David go with them. So the king sends David back. But why don't you just go back and guard the baggage? And so that's what David protests. Like, no, I've been faithful to you this whole time. Why can't I go? Because I'm telling you, the generals will not let you go with us. This is very important for a very important reason, that David is not with the Philistines when this happens. What is the reason why God does not allow David to fight with the Philistines in this battle? What happens in this battle? Very end of 1 Samuel. Saul and Jonathan die. They're killed in battle, right? And if David is in the army fighting with the Philistines, that ends up defeating Saul and kills him, David, it looks like David kills his opponent and takes the throne in his stead, right? God doesn't want that to happen. God is going to vindicate David. David doesn't have to do anything, right? David needs to stay away from there. And in fact, it's so like over the top that when a survivor from the battle comes back and reports to David what had happened. Now, Saul had committed suicide because he saw the battle was over and he was going to die. So he has his armor bearer kill him, and then the armor bearer kills himself. This guy runs to tell David that Saul is dead, and this guy wants to curry favor with David, and he assumes, well, Saul's your enemy, so you want to see him dead, and so I'm going to take the credit for it, even though I didn't do it, because, you know, that way you'll like me. And when David first hears the story, well, you know, he died. How did it happen? Well, he asked me to kill him because he knew the battle was over. And David strikes him down. Strike down this man. You heard it from his own mouth. He struck down the Lord's anointed. Right? So the 2 Samuel begins with David giving this long-winded lament about the death of Saul and Jonathan and about how God had chosen them and used them and how he mourned their death and he wasn't happy about it. So all of this is meant to illustrate that David does not take the kingdom for himself. Let's bring this all the way back to Jesus submits to John the Baptist to anoint him. Jesus doesn't usurp authority on his own authority. You know, he lets God's own channels of grace give it to him. Likewise, David. He doesn't usurp authority. He doesn't take authority. He doesn't take out Saul. He provides every opportunity for Saul to calm down and relent, and Saul doesn't do it because Saul is a king like the nations. You asked for it. David is a man after God's heart, and he's faithful to God, and he would rather be a fugitive in the desert, estranged from his own wife, and sort of flying about, waiting for God to vindicate him and take matters into his own hands. And that's the man that God wants to lead his people. A man who is above all faithful and believes that no matter what comes, God will make good on his word. It's an incredible story of faith. It's one of my favorite stories in the whole Old Testament about how so often we try to manipulate ourselves and make it work itself out. And that's not God's MO with David. Just wait, David. I told you you'd be king, and you will be. David believes and waits, and God brings it about that David becomes king. And this is how God says to Israel, this is the man I want. If you're asking me, this is the guy. And this is the beginning of Israel's monarchy. So when I said reclaiming the throne, you know, David's story represents how God, you know, having been usurped by the people, give us a king of the nations, God lets them have what they want. But then God in David begins to bring back the kingdom to himself. And of course, it's not just by raising up men who are faithful to him, ultimately, what God does. And we'll see this in more detail next week. God raises up an heir of David after the flesh, who is God himself. So David's own heir becomes God. It's almost like the greatest gift that God could possibly give David for his faithfulness, that his own line becomes the line through which the Messiah, who is God, establishes his reign on the earth. And so ultimately, God is actually restoring the kingdom to himself, because Jesus is both David's heir and also David's Lord in some mysterious providence that even baffles us modern Christians who know the story. So that's the story of David, and that's next week we'll talk a little bit more about how God makes a promise to David that this is going to come out about in this way. Any questions about the story? Yeah, Michael. Right.
David was a liar for him and believes that. Why does it seem like in 17 when David goes,
Saul doesn't recognize him?
Saul doesn't seem to recognize him at all.
Yeah. That's a complex question. Suffice it to say that there are ways that it could be read to suggest that Saul didn't actually know David personally. You know, David was playing in his court. But may not have actually had direct contact with him. Because there would have been an entourage of people around him who would have spoken for him. And
it seems the way it's described is in 16 is Saul loved David and made him his armor bearer.
Right. Yeah, so the armor bearer thing, I mean, so kings in the ancient Near East had a set number of titles for their court. And people would be given these titles even if their actual job had nothing to do with it, right? So, like, we see this even in the book of Genesis, that Joseph, a guy is a cupbearer for the Pharaoh. And we know from Egyptian records that have survived that men would have these titles, a cupbearer or armor bearer, and they would have been the equivalent of the Secretary of the Economy or something. Like, they have these honorary titles that don't actually describe what they do. You know, they're members of the kingly court. So David might have given this title armor bearer because he was of service to Saul, but he wasn't actually bearing Saul's armor. He would have just been a member of a larger court which is surrounding Saul, and he plays music. You know, music is loud and travels, and he doesn't necessarily have to be seen by Saul directly to have, I've heard his playing. It's a complex question, and I'm not even sure if that answer, frankly, is satisfying, but it seems as if the author of Samuel wants us to see David sort of entering into the court, both as a warrior on the one hand, but also as a man who is in tune with the supernatural and is able to tame spirits. And so, in every way, he's superior to Saul. And just like the ancient authors aren't as committed to a tight scientific telling of history the way modern historians tend to be, the author is just trying to make that point. Does that make sense? Right, and that's right. And some people have speculated, have used that exact comparison that we see even in the Hebrew scriptures. This happening, where the same narrative is told twice from different angles, and maybe that's what's happening here. And we're seeing David's introduction to the court in two ways that highlights two different ways in which David is superior to Saul. Yeah. Any other questions about the David story? It's one of my favorite stories in the Old Testament. It's a shame that I never get to preach on it from the pulpit because it's never assigned as one of the readings. It's been one of the strongest stories for me as I've grown in faith and obedience to the Lord and what it means to trust in God no matter what the circumstances. God has promised that we are his sons and daughters, we're his people, and that he works for the good in all things if we just trust him. And if we wait, if we stop trying to take things in our own hands by being manipulative or whatever, God will vindicate us in this life or the next. And David's life, just that's his story. David is just so responsive to the voice of God that it's a remarkable example of faith despite appearances. So it's one of the reasons I love it so much. So if anybody ever asks me, well, who's your favorite biblical character? It's David, hands down, because of this narrative. It's so rich. And even later in David's reign, when he messes up, he's still humble. Like we saw what Saul did when Samuel calls him out, and he's shifting blame. He's like, well, fine, I said, but save face with me. You know, when Nathan calls out David for what happens with Bathsheba, you know, he basically knocks off her husband, kills him, because to cover up his adultery. And when Nathan rebukes David, David's response is immediate. You know, I'm guilty. Yeah, guilty. And then, you know, God says, I'm going to take the baby. And David fasts and prays. And the baby dies anyway. And then David cleans up. And his servants are like, well, you fasted and mourned when he was alive. But now that he's dead, you're not anymore. And David's like, well, God, you know, maybe he would have spared his life. But he didn't. And the Lord gives, the Lord takes away. Let's go, let's move on. What's next? That's kind of David's attitude. Not because he doesn't, I think, mourn the loss of his son, but because he knows that God's at work and that he's faithful to God. And so even in failure, David is humble and acknowledges his weakness, which is why he remains God's favorite throughout his life. And we'll get into that and how much God is just over the moon for David next week when we come back. So that's next week. You guys only have one chapter to read next week, so you have no excuse not to read it. Please read 2 Samuel chapter 7, okay? And then we'll talk about what that means next week.